essay is Our Glory or Our Condemnation. It was originally presented on October 6, 1971, at Brigham Young University, and it later appeared in Hugh Nibley's book, Approaching Zion. Our Glory or Our Condemnation. If I thought this really was my last lecture, it would be to an empty hall, because it would be at least 10 hours long, and I would be the only auditor, inured to boredom by a lifelong habit of talking to myself. The subject would certainly be the 10th article of faith. That is why the lecture would have to be so long, because Article 10 has at least 5 distinct parts, and this talk will be only a brief outline of one of them. If there's anything that sets the gospel of Jesus Christ apart from all other religions of the world, and this could be demonstrated in detail, it's the literal, matter-of-fact view it takes of realities in this life and beyond this life, the view resting on the experience of very real and vivid contacts between man upon the earth and beings from higher spheres. This sense of literal reality is most clearly set forth in our 10th article of faith. The other articles have to do with our beliefs, principles, ordinances, and divine gifts. They are timeless in their application and could belong to any dispensation. But Article 10 deals explicitly with our time and our space and sets forth the steps by which God intends to consummate this great latter-day work. There are 5 such steps. 1. The literal gathering of Israel. Note the word literal. 2. The restoration of the 10 tribes. 3. The building of Zion, the New Jerusalem, upon the American continent. Is that specific enough? 4. Christ's personal reign upon the earth, not spiritual, in some undefined realm. And 5. The renewal of the earth in its paradisiacal glory. In each of these steps, earthly time and place are implicit. The statement does not pinpoint either, but it leaves no doubt at all that things are going to happen in a definite temporal order and involve people living in definite places on this particular planet. The Latter-day Saints have often become confused about the game plan of unfolding processes in these latter days by giving undue priority to one event over another or by arbitrarily shifting the order of events to suit some preconceived plans of their own. But one thing is clear. The Lord has given us here an outline of the whole plan as far as it concerns us. It behooves us, therefore, to keep the whole plan in mind and, as in all great projects, never to lose sight of the ultimate goal while we are working toward the necessary intermediate goals or steps. Here, the final step in the whole progression is that the earth will be renewed and receive its paradisiacal glory. Quite literally, heaven is our destination. This idea is clearly brought forward in our new home evening manual with its theme, A Bit of Heaven. That is more than a sentimental Irish tag, though we in the church today do seem to have an incurable appetite for trite and sentimental kitsch. It is an invitation, actually, to model our domestic life on the celestial order, as God commanded the saints to do from the first. And Zion cannot be built up unless it is by the principles of the law of the celestial kingdom, otherwise I cannot receive her unto myself. A bit of heaven? What is heaven like? What will Zion be like? We Mormons do not believe with Descartes that God is the self-thinking thinker who thinks only of thought. We think of the mind as reacting to other minds and to its own physical surroundings. We think of its operations as affecting others and also affecting those surroundings. The spirit of man, as it were, projects itself into the surrounding world and leaves its mark. We believe that heaven is not only a state of mind, but an actual environment. Brother and Sister De Hoyos have written about a celestial culture. There is most certainly a celestial environment. Every way of life produces its own environment and in turn is influenced by that environment. It is possible for a powerful mind to have joy amidst vile surroundings, but it can have greater joy in pleasant surroundings. There are degrees of joy, and God wants our joy to be full, that is, with every possible factor contributing. Milton Satan declares when he is cast out of heaven, the mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven. But that same Satan misses his heavenly home, and when he sees the glories of God's earth, he covets them, lusts after them, and yearns to possess them. The story of the Garden of Eden teaches us that environment is important. It was not a matter of indifference to Adam whether he was inside the garden or outside, whether he was living in a world most glorious and beautiful or in a dark and dreary world. And our Article 10 assures us that God intends that the paradisiacal conditions of Eden shall be restored again to this earth. Again we repeat, the earth will be renewed and receive its paradisiacal glory. What then is heaven like? Paul tells us, "But as it is written, eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart, that is, the imagination, of man, the things which God hath prepared for them that love him." But paradise is its earthly counterpart, the nearest earthly approach to heaven. This state is going to be restored to earth, but in a series of steps. If it were brought all at once, right now, the culture shock would kill us. Indeed, we have been given the challenge, "Who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth?" Only those who have prepared for the new environmental change by adapting themselves to it through a rigorous course of training. First must come the literal gathering of Israel, in which we are now engaged. Then the return of the 10 tribes, which we hope is soon to come. Then the building up of the kingdom of God on earth, preparatory to the establishment of Zion. Zion, in turn, preparing the earth to receive the Lord, after whose coming it will be possible to achieve the final state in which the earth is renewed and given its former glory. The midpoint and focus of the whole operation is Zion. Zion is the great moment of transition, the bridge between the world as it is and the world as God designed it and meant it to be. We'd better say a few things about Zion here. Zion is a code word denoting a very real thing. Zion is any community in which the celestial order prevails. Zion is the pure in heart. But Zion is also a real city or any number of real cities. It is a constant. It is unchanging. There are Zions among all the worlds, and there are Zions that come and go. Zion is a constant in time and place. It belongs to the order of the eternities. We're not making Zion here, but we're preparing the ground to receive it. As the Lord says, "My people must be tried in all things, that they may be prepared to receive the glory that I have for them, even the glory of Zion, and he that will not bear chastisement is not worthy of my kingdom." We must be prepared to receive this glory. We don't produce it ourselves. We must be ready so that we won't die of shock when we get it. In every dispensation, we are told, there has been a Zion on the earth. First of all, in the time of Adam, when the Holy One of Zion established the foundations of Adam on Diamond. After Adam, Enoch had his Zion when the Lord called his people Zion, and Enoch built a city that was called the City of Holiness, even Zion. But then it came to pass that Zion was not, for God received it up into his own bosom, and from thence went forth the saying, "Zion is fled." Zion comes and goes. When the world cannot support Zion, Zion is not destroyed, but taken back home. "And thou hast taken Zion to thine own bosom from all thy creations," says Moses 7:31. And when the world is qualified to receive Zion, there shall be mine abode, and it shall be Zion, which shall come forth out of all the creations which I have made. Accordingly, the ancient prophets of Israel yearned for the time when Zion would be restored again. Jeremiah and Isaiah hoped to see Zion restored in their time. They certainly knew it would come in a later day. Typical of their attitude is the prophecy of the psalmist, "My days are like a shadow that declineth, and I am withered like grass. But thou, O Lord, shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time is come. When the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory." And then he adds, "This shall be written for the generation to come." "After all the calamities," said Jeremiah, "there shall be a day that the watchmen upon the Mount Ephraim shall cry, 'Arise ye, and let us go up to Zion, unto the Lord our God.'" And, of course, we all know the prophecy of Micah, chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. "But in the last days the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the tops of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it, and many nations shall come, for the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." This was the hope of the prophets. It was also anticipated in the days of the ancient apostles, that ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, as Paul describes the church. But it's in the last days that the fulfillment will really get underway with the restoration and the steps approaching the establishment of Zion. In every age, though, as the Doctrine and Covenants tells us, the saints are they who are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly place, the holiest of all, the general assembly and church of Enoch, and of the firstborn. That is the eternal order of Zion, and the saints have been at work for many years, supposedly preparing to receive it. What is this ideal Zion like? In the last days, we are told, it will be a place of refuge in a doomed world. It shall be called the New Jerusalem, a land of peace, a city of refuge, a place of safety for the saints of the Most High God. And the terror of the Lord also shall be there, and it shall be called Zion. At that time, every man that will not take his sword against his neighbor must needs flee unto Zion for safety. And the wicked shall say that Zion is terrible. Terrible because it is indestructible. Her invulnerability makes her an object of awe and terror. As Enoch said, "Surely Zion shall dwell in safety forever." But the Lord said unto Enoch, "Zion have I blessed, but the residue of the people have I cursed." So Zion was taken away, and the rest destroyed. Zion itself is never in danger. On the contrary, it alone offers safety to the world, that the gathering together upon the land of Zion and upon her stakes may be for a defense and for a refuge from the storm and from wrath when it shall be poured out without mixture upon the whole earth. It would seem that Zion enjoys the complete security of a bit of the celestial world and that nothing can touch it as long as it retains the character. But celestial order it must be. As we have seen, Zion cannot be built up unless it is by the principles of the law of the celestial kingdom. It must at all times be holy enough to receive the Lord Himself in person. For the Lord hath chosen Zion, He hath desired it for His habitation. Behold mine abode forever. Zion is heaven. It is where God lives, a bit of heaven indeed. The two words most commonly used to describe Zion are beauty and joy. And the same two words most often relate to heaven and paradise. Beauty comes first, for beauty is whatever gives joy. Now we approach the question of what Zion looks like. The city of our God, beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. Let Mount Zion rejoice, let the daughters of Judah be glad. Walk about Zion and go round about her. An eminently delightful place, out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God hath shined. For Zion must increase in beauty and in holiness. Zion must arise and put on her beautiful garments. And blessed are they who shall seek to bring forth my Zion at that day, and whoso shall publish peace, how beautiful upon the mountains shall they be. These are more than figures of speech. As President Joseph F. Smith put it, things upon the earth, so far as they have not been perverted by wickedness, are typical of things in heaven. Heaven was the prototype of this beautiful creation when it came from the hand of the Creator and was pronounced good. There you have the environment of Zion, and for a foretaste of it, all we have to do is go to the canyons and look around us. For the earth comes from the hand of the Creator, most glorious and beautiful, with great rivers, small streams, and mountains and hills to give variety and beauty to the scene, designed by God as a place of beauty and delight. That is the way we must keep it. The order of Zion is such as will leave the earth as near its primordial, paradisiacal condition as possible. The paradise of Eden is called in the Scriptures the Garden of the Lord, and we are told that God and His holy angels delighted to come to it and commune with Adam in its delightful surroundings. This earth has been compared by many, most recently by a Latter-day Saint pharmacologist, Dr. A.B. Morrison, to an exquisitely equipped spaceship. It is enormously productive and contains an unlimited supply for all who come to live on it, as long as they use its bounty with judgment, not to excess, neither by extortion, the Lord has said. That is, properly distributed, without waste or inequality. It contains all things made for the benefit and the use of man, both to please the eye and to gladden the heart, yea, for food and for raiment, for taste and for smell, to strengthen the body and to enliven the soul. Notice here that the eye and the heart have priority over the stomach, that taste and smell have claims equal to appetite, that the enlivening of the soul is as important as the strengthening of the body. And out of the ground made I, the Lord God, to grow every tree, naturally, that is pleasant to the sight of man, and man could behold it. Here the value of trees as a crop is not even mentioned, and God plainly does not share the belief of another august personage that once you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. All the creations are His work, said Brigham Young, and they are for His glory and for the benefit of the children of men, and all things are put into the possession of man for his comfort, improvement, and consolation, and for his health, wealth, beauty, and excellency. But if the earth is perfectly adapted and completely outfitted for all our physical and spiritual needs, what is there left for us to do? Won't it weaken our character to have everything handed to us ready and prepared for our use? That question, the most natural one in the world to ask in our society, shows how far removed we are from the celestial order of things. It's the same question that is asked by the small boy who comes to visit you for summer vacation. If a guy can't break everything around the house and yard, drown kittens, shoot birds, cut down the apple tree, take the baby buggy apart, stick things in the piano, throw rocks at bottles, what can a guy do? If we advised the little fellow to acquire more sophisticated tastes and follow our example, to seek his diversions more constructively as we do, watching westerns on TV, going hunting, playing golf, going to football games, attending X-rated movies, or driving a car, he can protest that such activities differ from his own only in being more passive and less imaginative, but really they are quite as trivial and immature and unproductive as his. We might then admonish him to hard work. Pope Gregory VII wrote a letter to the Bishop of Reims in the 11th century in which he told how the barons of the time were literally destroying Europe in thousands of private wars and feuds and raids on each other's castles and lands and serfs, and how, when he protested what they were doing, they asked him in all seriousness, "If we don't do this, what else is there for us to do? For what other purpose were gentlemen placed upon the earth? What else can a normal man possibly want to do?" The activities of the modern world that go by the name of work may not have been as spectacularly destructive as those of the barons of the Middle Ages, yet we are beginning to find out now that they are destructive. And it is high time that we begin to ask ourselves, as we ask the little fellow who's spending the summer with us, whether what we are doing is really what we ought to be doing. There is full-time employment for all simply in exploring the world without destroying it. And by the time we begin to understand something of its marvelous richness and complexity, we'll also begin to see that it does have uses that we never suspected, and that its main value is what comes to us directly from mere coexistence with living things, the impact on our minds and bodies, subtle and powerful, that goes far beyond the advantages of converting all things into cash or calories. Now, we all know that Adam could not stay in the garden. He was expelled and told to get his living by the sweat of his brow. In return for hard physical labor, the earth would yield him of her abundance. It was a fair exchange. He was to put hard work into the soil, and in return the soil would sustain him. He was to live by work, though, not by plunder. I spent my mission among the fields of Europe, which had been under the plow for literally thousands of years, and were still yielding their abundance. After my mission, I visited a glorious redwood grove near Santa Cruz, California. Only there was no grove there. The 2,000-year-old trees were all gone. Not one of them was left standing. My own grandfather had converted them all into cash. It wasn't hard to do in those days. You looked up the right people, you got your name on some pieces of paper, and presto, you were rich for a short while, and the earth was impoverished forever. I am pleased to state that my grandfather recognized that there was something wrong with this, that he was not fulfilling the commandment given to Adam, that it was not the kind of work Adam was assigned to do. There was no proportion whatever between the amount of work and the return, between what man took from the earth and what he gave to it. Grandfather took something priceless and irreplaceable and gave in return a few miles of railroad ties. He not only broke the cycle of life so beautifully exemplified in those all but immortal groves, he destroyed it for quick wealth, which served only to corrupt his children and lead them out of the church. In those days, we enjoyed a feeling of immense prosperity through the simple device of using up in 20 or 30 years those reserves of nature's treasury that were meant to last for 1,000 years. With such prodigal waste, of course, we were living high. There's no permanency in economy that takes 100 from nature and gives back 1. There's no survival value in such an operation, which is certainly the business of systematic and organized looting, the very opposite of making a fair exchange with the earth. Above all, it ignores the ancient doctrine of man's obligation to quicken the earth that bears for him. The old Jewish teaching is that Adam had a right only to that portion of the earth that he quickened, on which he labored with the sweat of his brow. Let us not confuse the ethic of work with the ethic of plunder. Granted that when Adam was turned out of the garden, he immediately got to work, as instructed, to render the new region in which he found himself as much like his former paradise as possible. And angels came and showed him how he could work his way back to the type of paradise he had left. The Order of Zion already established that Adam was to prepare the earth to resume its paradisiacal glory as soon as possible. Zion is a return to a former state of excellence. The gospel message today is that we must prepare ourselves to return to the garden again by the wisdom of hard experience. But he was to return. It is in that state and in those paradisiacal surroundings that he is to spend the eternities. The saints in every dispensation have always worked and prayed for the day when God shall open the gates of paradise, and he shall remove the threatening sword against Adam, and he shall give to the saints to eat from the tree of life, and all the saints shall clothe themselves with joy. Zion is to be the headquarters for God's reconquest of the earth. For the land of Zion shall be a seat and a place to receive and do all these things. Again, verily I say unto you, my friends, a commandment I give unto you, that ye shall commence a work of laying out and preparing a beginning and foundation of the city of the stake of Zion, here in the land of Kirtland, beginning at my house. Here we are dealing with the first steps only, not the culmination. The church is a trial run for Zion, just as Zion is for paradise, and as paradise is for the heaven of God. It is a place of gathering. All things there shall be gathered together in one. They shall be of one heart and one mind, and there are no poor among them. In every dispensation that it has been upon the earth, Zion is described in the same terms.